We've made it.
This is how we know we're back in civilization. We're, like, trying to park the van. Like, we haven't had to parallel park in, like, Rock Springs, Wyoming. Oh. Sorry.
Very, very close to the terminal. Good.
Okay.
She's parallel parking. She's doing a fabulous job.
Sacramento, the final stop on our trip before heading home to L.A.
Driving that stresses me the fuck.
Parking meters and public transpo and Starbucks, more civilization than the Donner Party could ever have imagined.
All right, now we're here in Sacramento.
Yeah. At Sutter's. So is this a Sutter's Fort?
Yeah, so this is where they were always trying to get to.
Oh, wow.
So where they just were, where we just were, Johnson's Ranch, was like the first stop, and then they would come here afterwards.
Gotcha. But that was closer, obviously, to where they were.
In the mountains, yeah. So they would wind down from the... So they basically went from Truckee Lake to Johnson's Ranch to here. And it feels kind of fitting that we're now in, like, the center of a city.
Yeah. We're civilization.
Which I think is just representative of, like... how much bigger this fort was compared to, like, the tiny town we were just in.
Yep.
And this looks like a fort. Like, this is, like, a big white-walled structure.
Yeah, I wonder... I mean, clearly is not how it originally looked, but I guess it's surrounding the spot that would have been the fort.
Right. So this is the big fort that was run by John Sutter, and this is... the place he runs sort of in the style of a southern plantation.
Right.
What a guy.
He's the one who sent the two basically enslaved boys, the good boys, back with the bachelor, right?
Yeah, exactly. So when Charles Stanton and Big Bill McCutcheon ride ahead for supplies, they come here and buy them and then bring them back. But Big Bill doesn't go because he's sick.
Right. So Big Bill's still here?
Yes.
Big Bill.
Ew. And this is also... John Sutter is the man who made the business deal with Lansford W. Hastings.
Right. To get people out here.
Right. So this is sort of the end and, like, the beginning of our story.
Before us stood the restored Sutter's Fort, a collection of buildings with pointed roofs surrounded by a tall white stone wall. But the wall, surely meant to keep the wilderness and the Miwok and the Madju out, could not contain the settlers who arrived here. They spilled out from the fort, created shops and businesses, jails and parks, bridges and roads, capitol buildings and banks, and then colleges and ski resorts and Mickey Mouse and Facebook. But... as Mary Ann Graves and Virginia Reed and Big Bill McCutcheon and the kind William Eddy stood right here outside the gates of Sutter's Fort in the very new year of 1847, were they thinking about everything California would become? Or were they thinking about everyone they had lost? I have come to believe, pretty firmly, that the head and the heart can hold more than one thing to be true. That grief and hope have something in common because they are both acknowledgments that time only moves forward. Which means that I too have to move on. With every mile Hope and I have driven or hiked or drank from Missouri to here, I have been slowly walking away from the Donner Party. But on that journey, I too had made wrong turns and new friends. Had crossed the plains and the desert and climbed the mountains, I'd crashed the van and still somehow became an overlander myself. Because when I looked out across this wide, complicated country, I could not help but find it incredibly beautiful. So here I am in Sacramento, with hope. And you, finally ready to say goodbye with the last episode of Overlanders.
I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going home.
All right.
Okay.
Last episode was rough.
Yeah, that was rough. I didn't like that.
I didn't like writing it.
Yeah, it's just like they got so far and then it got like 10 times, just like all of that. It was like Reno on steroids, but he had already, I mean, at the end, they had already done so much hard work.
And there is something so terrible, I think, about making it to the end, you know, and not making it. Should we get to some like happy stuff?
Yes, please.
Not like really happy. I mean, like happy compared to, everything is happy compared to what we just read.
Yeah.
The fourth relief arrived back at the lake camp much later than expected. The third relief, led by Williams, Foster, and Eddie, had left four adults and one ailing child. Lavinia Murphy turned away as the men carried her son to safety. Her work was done. Her boy was safe. There was also Louis Kiesberg, who had been left due to his bad foot and rumors he had murdered the sons of Williams, Foster, and Eddie. Then there was George Donner, who had been slowly succumbing to an infection in his hand for months. His nephew Samuel, the son of his brother and faithful companion Jacob, who George had had to feed his daughters to survive. And then there was Tamsin. She had gotten all her daughters to safety, turned down rescue three times. Ultimately, when William Foster and William Eddy asked if she would leave with them, she said she could not leave George and little Samuel.
Oh my God, Tamsin!
She would wait for the fourth relief party. But the fourth relief was delayed by bad weather again and again. They arrived close to a month after the third relief left the lake. What they found were books and silks, shoes and bits of furniture scattered everywhere, and body parts. The snow was melting, artifacts of civilization among green and gore. The rescue party pressed on to the Alder Creek camp, where Tamsin and George had been staying.
Oh.
George was dead, his body mutilated.
Oh my God.
And there was no Tamsin. The men camped there, somehow. And the next day, they went back to the lake camp, which is like 8 miles away.
Right.
And they find Louis Kiesberg in the Breen cabin. Alone, boiling organs. The men were freaked out and suspicious. They demanded Kiesberg tell them how he survived. Kiesberg, a giant of a man, like, and he's got like this big beard and like these piercing blue eyes, said he'd survived by eating body parts.
Of who?
He said that Lavinia, George, and Samuel had died long ago. So within the month, earlier in the month.
Oh, so the young boy, George Donner.
And his nephew, who was Jacob Donner's son.
And then Lavinia Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Who was like on her way out for a long time as well. But where was Tamsin? Kiesberg said she too had died. He said she had come to him babbling about escaping the mountains. And then she lay down to sleep and never woke up again. But none of her remains were ever found.
Oh.
But Kiesberg would be forever accused of killing Tamsin, partially because...
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it.
Partially because he had hidden away her money, and partially because like he had her money hidden on him.
Oh my God.
And partially because since the outset of the trip, Kiesberg had been unlikable, foreign, angry. As the fourth relief led him, the lone survivor, out of the mountains... He stumbles over the body of his daughter, Ada, who he didn't know had died.
Oh my gosh.
Or probably didn't know had died. The members of the Fourth Relief would spread rumors about what they'd seen and what they thought Kiesberg had done. They reached Sutter's Fort. The Donner Party's journey was over. It had taken over a year, thanks in large part to a shortcut that was anything but. They had been trapped in the mountains for 111 days.
Oy.
It took very little time for word of what had happened in the mountains to reach the ears of other Californians. Ears turned to press. Soon California was on fire with the sordid, tragic tale of the Donner Party. Many of the rescuers, especially James Reed, downplayed what they'd witnessed at the camps. George Donner would never live to dig his hands into the soil here, coach something to grow. James Reed would do what he could to not allow rumors to thrive in the place of his friend's dreams.
Mm.
But of course he failed. The tale the rescuers and survivors did tell was grotesque and heartbreaking. As we've learned, it kind of has everything. So of course it sold many papers and books. Editors often beefed up claims of the survival cannibalism, which seems like maybe the most insane about any of this to me. I mean, how much more cannibalism could you possibly need to add to the story?
Yeah.
Some survivors would never admit to what they and their parents had done to survive. Even now, there are people who try and deny cannibalism happened.
Oh.
Like descendants of the Donners and stuff.
Oh.
Or they claim the story is just like overly sensationalized.
Right.
As the survivors left Johnson's Ranch and Sutter's Fort, they fanned out into Napa Valley, where the land was just as beautiful as they'd heard.
Yeah.
Sarah Graves struggled to care for her siblings, but by 1848 had remarried someone she actually knew from back east. Hmm. She also started teaching. For a little while, things were good. But Sarah's husband was accused of stealing mules and hung before his trial. So she remarries a kind farmer. He was a widower as well. He needed a wife, his children a mother. Sarah needed a husband, her children a father. She had kids with the guy who was hung.
Right.
So she and this nice man were married out of logic, which made sense.
Right.
Sarah had already married for love, although that time with Jay seemed like a lifetime ago.
Mm.
Marianne Graves quickly married, like really quickly, like within like a month.
Oh.
And she married someone who we've actually met in our story very briefly. She met the guy who immediately proposed to Virginia Reed.
Oh, that guy was getting around.
That guy was like,
I want one of these girls.
He's like, I need to be married. And Marianne Graves is like, I need to do something different. This was her equivalent of like a bad haircut.
Oh my God.
Although, unfortunately, that dude is murdered a few years later.
Oh my God.
I know. But she does.
I am so thankful that I am not alive during this time.
I know.
You just like walk out your door and it's like, I didn't like you. I mean, that fucking happens today. I hate humans.
But Marianne Graves allegedly brings the murderer like food every day while he's in jail because she wants to make sure he lives to be hung.
Damn. She's like, I want to see you suffer.
She's hardcore. I mean, she says after her husband is murdered, I wish I could cry, but I cannot. If I could forget the tragedy, perhaps I would know how to cry again. She would remarry and have 7 children.
Wow.
After Sarah died, Marianne took in her daughters. As she got older, she was known for intimidating people and smoking a clay pipe.
Love that for her. I love that for her.
The other Graves girls got married and had kids as well. They all became popular, prominent members of the new community in Napa Valley. William Graves, who's their oldest brother, who's 17 at the lake camp, became a prospector and blacksmith. 2 years after the tragedy, while on a prospecting expedition, if that is what they are called, William Graves led a group to Donner Lake. They heard gold was up there. But he leaves them for the afternoon. He doesn't return to this place that had brought him so much pain.
Yeah, how could you go back?
He wasn't alone. His sisters, too, would suffer for the rest of their lives from what they'd seen and felt that winter, especially Nancy Graves, who was the 9-year-old who was left with the Breens in the pit.
Oh, yeah.
Because she wasn't told until after that the Breens had fed her mother to keep her alive.
Oh, my God.
And something interesting Daniel James Brown talks about in The Indifferent Stars Above is the difference here between guilt and shame.
Yeah.
Guilt is productive because it means something you did embarrassed you. You can learn from it. But shame is toxic because it means you are embarrassed of who you are.
Jeez, wow.
Almost 50 years after the winter of 1846, a prospector stumbles across something interesting in the mountains. A bag of coins near Donner Lake.
Oh.
The Graves children were able to identify them as their mother's coins. She'd buried them when she left the lake. Even as their mother struggled to survive, she thought of her children's futures because she knew her family would go on. They were scrappy and tough and loving and relentless.
Right.
And that's nothing to be ashamed of.
No.
The Breen family settled in San Juan Batuista. Have you been there?
Sure. No.
Sounds beautiful. It's in California. Their son, John, was one of a few Donner Party survivors who had returned to the mountains that had trapped them and came back with gold.
Oh.
The Breen family used the money to buy huge chunks of land. Patrick and Peggy Breen lived the rest of their lives happy, well-liked, and wealthy.
Wow. Good for them.
The Donner girls originally kind of like haunted Sutter's Fort. They would wander from person to person, telling whoever would listen, asking for food, saying, "We are the children of Mr. and Mrs. George Donner, and our parents are dead."
Oh my God.
Their family, as everyone knew, had suffered the most losses. They were housed by some survivors of the party, including the Reeds, but the Donner children didn't need to rely on charity forever. Eliza Donner went on to marry a future mayor of San Jose, who had previously been married to Eliza's cousin, one of Jacob's daughters. In 1911, Eliza Donner published a book about her family's fate. They all married and lived long lives. The last Donner died in 1930.
Wow.
1930.
That's wild.
The oldest daughter at the time of the tragedy never spoke of what had happened. However, every year when the local school did their Donner Party unit, she would go and sit quietly in the back of the class.
The daughter, the girl?
One of the Donner daughters.
Oh, like she wouldn't want to.
She wouldn't ever talk about it, but she would just go and just sit there.
Oh.
Lewis and Philippine Kiesberg were reunited and had 8 more children.
Jeez.
Lewis Kiesberg opened up a brewery in the Sacramento area and was the first to introduce lagers to the area.
Oh.
He was briefly a success until a flood ruined his business. Lewis Kiesberg would forever be known as a cannibal, even though many people had also resorted to it. The rumors followed him wherever he went, with many saying he bragged about Tamsin's liver, saying it was the sweetest morsel he'd ever tasted.
Oh.
He spent the rest of his life defending himself, saying he hadn't killed Tamsin. In the 1870s, he met with Tamsin's daughter, Eliza, and fell to his knees pleading she believe him. He did admit to eating her mother's remains, but Eliza forgave him anyway. His descendants in the California area have supposedly changed their names.
Oh, wow.
Lavinia's younger children also found wealth and success. One of them, William, who had been the last in the cabin with her, went on to be district attorney of Yuba County and founded a church in the area. Her son-in-law, William Foster, who had killed Louis and Salvador, became a prospector. Foster's Bar is still named for him. That's what I read, and I was like, oh, we'll get a drink there. But it's actually like a sandbar in a river. I was like, what time are they open?
When's the last call?
Big Bill McCutcheon became sheriff of San Jose County.
Oh, that checks out.
William Eddy, left with no family after the tragedy, remarried.
Oh, my God. So William Eddy, the sweet Eddies,
mm-hmm.
he lost everyone?
Mm-hmm.
That was really sad.
He remarries, but he does go on to get divorced.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. But no one has a happier ending than James Reed.
Oh.
The land he'd purchased while his family was trapped was turned to bountiful farms. And in 1848, 1 year after the tragedy, gold was discovered on his land.
Oh.
He remained one of San Jose's most prominent citizens for the rest of his life. Many streets there are named for he and his children, and a large chunk of his land was donated to San Jose University.
Wow.
He would never speak about the murder of John Snyder that had had him banished from the party. But he did write that our misfortunes were the result of bad management. Had I remained with the company, I would have had the whole of them over the mountains before the snow would have caught them.
Oh, please.
And those who have got through have admitted this to be true.
He doesn't give up.
Well, I don't know if that's true, if James Reed's judgment was that superior. I do have a little bit of doubt, though, based purely on the fact that shortly after settling in the San Jose area, James Reed entered into a business partnership with Lansford W. Hastings.
I knew it. I fucking knew it.
Hastings, it might delight you to know, basically failed up for the rest of his life. His cutoff was not his last untested shortcut. He also became a lawyer, a judge, eventually the ultimate fail up, a major in the Confederate Army. When he, you know, lost that war, he then tried to establish a Confederate stronghold in South America.
No, ew.
He died somewhere on a ship shortly after publishing The Emigrant's Guide to Brazil.
Oh, Hastings can go. He's cut.
He's gone.
He's cut.
He's dead. I guess why I'm doing this roundup isn't because I can't bear to end this podcast on so much death. It's that the Donner Party lives in most people's minds as a pretty gruesome, contained thing. Due to bad weather and poor planning, people got stuck in the mountains and ate each other. That's kind of probably why people listen to this podcast. That's,
yeah,
you know. But what surprises people most when I talk with them about the Donner Party is that I don't talk about this as a horror story. I talk about it as a survival story, a rescue. About half the Donner Party made it out of the mountains, and many didn't slink away into the shadows. They became now just Californians, the first Californians. In a lot of ways, the Donner Party is California's origin story. Mm-hmm. When William Eddy and the rest of the Forlorn Hope stumble out of the woods, pale and naked, I mean, that's a creation myth, you know?
Right, right.
On one hand, it's incredible the lives these people went on to live. But on the other hand, what disturbs me is the disconnect. The Donner Party is a little side note in the history of Manifest Destiny. Their story became big and horrific, otherworldly, and that's because, I believe, the United States needed to turn the overlanders into something other than Americans, anything but Americans, because Americans needed to go to California, needed to complete the fever dream of Manifest Destiny. It could never happen to you. You'll be fine. Here, money, land, spread the red, white, and blue. So instead, the members of the Donner Party were transformed into characters, heroes and villains, saints and demons. Louis Kiesberg and Tamsin Donner seem like both ends of the spectrum. How fitting we try and end the story with them, an imposing German immigrant and a mother who had sacrificed herself for her husband. It's almost too convenient to pretend that the Donner Party ended there, and the children who had been misled and lied to by people they were supposed to trust, that the American government had trusted, the children who had been forced to eat the bodies of their parents did not, in fact, go on to become prominent members of the new Society of California. With money and land and power, they were able to move from members of the Donner Party back to being Americans. The kind of people you name schools and streets after. And what about the people who didn't make it out? How do we talk about Tamsin Donner? How have I? More insidious to the American mythology than the monster is the saint. Because Tamsin Donner was so quickly propped up as the woman who had completed all of her social feminine duties to the point of dying, she was canonized. The story of the Donner Party very quickly goes from one of terror to one of bravery by a few individuals. And the danger in that is that we miss the opportunity for accountability. The tragedy in the Sierras was a completely avoidable disaster. From the deal between John Sutter and Lansford Hastings to Hastings cutoff, to James Reed ignoring Kleiman's advice, to Jim Bridger and Louis Vasquez misleading the Donner Party into thinking the shortcut was safe, to the U.S. government in San Francisco ignoring the plight of James Reed. But those men all went on to have their names plastered all over the country. They were shielded by the bravery of people like Charles Stanton and Tamsin Donner. You know what Charles Stanton would have liked way more than being remembered as the hero of the Donner Party? Not dying. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what I've come to realize in writing all this and traveling and sleeping in a van is that the United States has used the story of the Donner Party, the tragedy, as the blueprint for how it handles every preventable loss of life in this country. And it's happening right now. In 2021, we are nearing the end of a pandemic, and we're already starting to Donner Party COVID. We're skipping right from the terror to the stories of brave individuals. Who is our Tamsin and Charles? Is it all the women who have stoically given up their careers to care for their kids? Is it the essential workers who've never left the front lines? How quickly will we forget how incredibly preventable so much of the death we've seen was? How soon will we erect statues to those who sacrificed themselves and re-elect those who got them killed? Mythology is no closer to history than reverence is to responsibility. The Donner Party has become a monolith, a being unto itself, lost with the snow and the bones and the people at the center of the story. I hope I made it about the people again. Almost every family lost someone they could not imagine living without. It's devastating and unfair, and I cannot leave the story there. So let me tell you why Tamsin's body was never found. It's because she was never there, never in the Breen's cabin. She did not watch George die. He didn't get sick. His brother never drove an axe into his hand. They never even owned a wagon. Tamsin had gone back east after her first husband and children died. She was still a young woman, but she was angry, lashing out at people. Her grief sat on her temper. She went to Illinois to help her brother with his children. And there, she wandered the fields collecting things that grew, things that were green and moved in the light breeze. When she reached out to touch them, she was reminded of how there was more life in the world than death. Teaching children gave her a sense of purpose. She started teaching more of them at the local school. She'd lead them out into the fields where they'd get lost for hours in the warm sun. There was nothing to impede the endless stretches of blue sky but tall trees. And then someone else, a tall, handsome man on horseback. Tamsin lifted her face to meet his gaze. Under his hat, he saw her large brown eyes, her pretty face. He hopped off his horse and crossed the space between them, extended a hand. Tamsin took it and was unsure if it was the good weather, the laughter of her class around her, but something in her felt lighter than it had in a very long time. George Donner felt it too. After so much loss in his life, after so much searching for what he did not know, he felt, still, their roving days were over. I know it's not honest to leave Tamsin and George Donner here, in a place that's warm and full of possibilities, at the start of their story. But after all this, I really don't care. After all, this has never been a story about honesty. It's been a story about America.
No words!
That's it?
Wow.
That's the end of the show. Thank you for listening to Overlanders. I'm Colleen Scriven. My co-host, the superior driver, has been Hope Andrajack. Our producer is my friend Liv Benger. Our editors are Liv and I. Our beautiful show art is by Kennedy Daniels, and our theme music is composed and performed by the talented Tristan Mattel with Hope Andrajack. If you'd like to know more about our show, please visit www.donnerpartypodcast.com.